neat rows expanding outward. The vehicles closest to the trio of buildings were in the greatest state of disrepair. The cars ran the gamut from Kias to Hyundais, but all were makes and models commonly seen on the streets of Iraq or Syria. By Jack's quick assessment, none of them were currently road-ready. Several had hoods propped open, and most were missing some portion of their frame. The way that the vehicle's vacant panels revealed their underlying skeleton struck Jack as strangely sinister, though he couldn't articulate why. Even so, he didn't have time to ponder the matter in great detail. Spurts of automatic weapons fire still ripped through the air, seasoned by intermittent explosions. Everyone seemed to be in a hurry to be somewhere else, and the scurrying groups of people reminded Jack of sailors reacting to a klaxon sounding general quarters. In that moment, he realized what he was seeing. The compound's defenders expected to be attacked and had rehearsed for this eventuality. Now they were reacting accordingly. To them, Jack was just another obstacle to circumvent as they raced to take up assigned defensive positions. For all intents and purposes, Jack was invisible. For now. As Jack drew closer, he saw a congregation of men lining up alongside the hodgepodge of civilian vehicles at the far end of the motor pool. Something about the gathering was out of place. While every other military-aged male was hurrying about with a weapon in his hands, the group of a dozen men was strangely still. Jack deviated from his path, angling toward the nearest Humvee to avoid getting caught up in the steadily growing stream of men standing at the far side of the motor pool. Then a man wearing a long white tobe and a matching white head cover exited the building, and like a blurry picture sliding into focus, the group rearranged itself into neat rows. The man began to speak, and though Jack was too far away to hear the words, the accompanying gestures his audience made were easy enough to recognize. They were praying. With artillery shells dropping and automatic weapons fire echoing across the compound, 12 men were praying. Why? Then Jack looked from the group of 12 to a series of neatly platooned cars arranged to the right of the building. Unlike the rest of the motor pool, this section was segregated with cyclone fence and a controlled access point. As Jack watched, the men finished their prayers and walked en masse toward the cyclone fence. Leading the way, the prayer leader unlocked the gate with a key he wore around his neck and then patted each man on the shoulder or back as they walked past him to enter. Jack looked from the cars to the men, to the tobe-wearing man, trying to understand what he was seeing. Then he had it. Unlike the rest of the compound's inhabitants, these men were clean-shaven. 12 beardless men had just prayed in the middle of a firefight and were now getting into a segregated fleet of vehicles. Vehicles that rode low on their tires. Son of a bitch. Jack was staring at 12 suicide bombers preparing to embark on their final mission. Just once he wanted the luxury of worrying about a single bad guy. Instead, he always seemed to be outmanned and undergunned as bad morphed into worse. In other words, just another day in paradise. The thought almost made Jack smile. But it was hard to smile, with a pistol pressing into your back. Chapter 76. In a strange way, the round length of metal jabbing him in the spine felt comforting. Unlike being confronted by a knife, where safety lay in distance, the odds of surviving an encounter with a gunman rose exponentially the closer they stood to their intended victim. This was not because a bullet was any less devastating at close range. A 115-grain projectile traveling at 1,180 feet per second shredded internal organs with ease, whether the gunman was 6 inches or 6 feet from his intended target. No, the advantage offered by proximity was that the closer a gunman stood, the greater chance the intended victim stood of disarming him. Jack's combatives instructors had taught him an easy way to judge distance even under stress. If you were close enough to touch the gunman's elbow, you were close enough to take away his pistol. As Jack had learned through practice, a gunman standing near enough to shove a pistol into your back didn't stand a chance. Assuming, of course, you had 2 working arms. Once again, Jack was less than impressed with the cards he'd been dealt. But long odds were better than no odds. If the unseen gunman wanted Jack dead, the man would have already shot him. This meant he would soon tell Jack to drop his rifle. Jack intended to comply, and then use the distraction of the AK falling to the ground to attempt the disarming maneuver he'd done countless times before. Except with just one hand. It wasn't ideal. Neither was dying. Jack readied himself, picturing how he would compensate for his damaged arm while trying to relax the tense muscles bulging across his back and shoulders. Here, speed mattered more than power, and it was hard to move fast with clenched muscles. But the command he was anticipating didn't come. At least, not the way he'd expected it. After a final poke to make sure he was paying attention, the pressure in his back vanished in conjunction with the sound of feet crunching on gravel as the gunman moved backward. Apparently, Jack wasn't the only one who'd had a combatives class or two. Put the rifle on the ground, slowly. Jack ground his teeth, an American accent, which meant that he probably looked like a farm boy from Iowa, the fake VC manager. So his Russian girlfriend had to be very slowly, or the hole I put in you this time will be much larger. The second distinctly feminine voice came from behind Jack and to his right. He couldn't see the waitress, but he was willing to bet she was standing well outside elbow-touching distance. And even if she wasn't, unless you were Steven Seagal, disarming two people was notoriously tricky. Trying it with just one hand might even give Steven pause. Jack slowly squatted to place the rifle on the ground as his mind raced. The good news was that he'd found the two people he'd been seeking. The bad news was that they'd found him first. Chapter 77 Reaper 7, Reaper 6, sit rep, over. Alex's call again came over the command frequency, and Kerry was grateful for the privacy. Reaper 6, this is Reaper 7, Kerry said. At least four of the missiles launched, and I'm still under direct fire from the compound. As if to punctuate Kerry's last statement, a DSHK machine gun shattered to life from one of the hardpoints on the compound's walls. Kerry ducked as the vehicle-killing bullets tore divots of soil from either side of the hide site, showering him with grit. Roger, Reaper 6 copies all. What about the American? He ran back into the compound, Kerry said, as he rechecked Jad's bandage. The wound had stopped seeping blood, but Jad had drifted into unconsciousness. Not good. I don't know what the American's doing, and I don't have time to care. Roger that, Reaper 7. Some hinky shit on my end, too. Someone pushed into our net, asking us to assist the American if possible. Apparently he's trying to locate additional hostages inside the compound. Over. Roger all, Kerry said, but he's on his own. I am pinned down and combat ineffective with one WIA classification urgent. Reaper 7 is requesting the QRF. Over.
Thought you'd never ask, Reaper 7, Alex said.
Sit tight, my friend. The cavalry is coming. A moment later, Alex's voice echoed over the team's internal frequency.
All Reaper elements, this is Reaper 6. I have the fight. QRF is launching time now, and we will be moving up MSR Whiskey to relieve Reaper 7 in place. Continue to place accurate fire on enemy positions, but avoid Sector 5 if possible. When I call release point Tango, suppress all target reference points with continuous fire until I've recovered Reaper 7. Acknowledge. Over.
Kerry listened as each Reaper callsign acknowledged Alex's instructions. Damn, but his team leader was on it. That boy would have made a good NCO. Reaper 7, this is Skillful 2-3. We are a flight of four at release point Sierra 2 inbound. Over. The decidedly feminine voice instantly cut through Kerry's testosterone-fogged mind. After 20 years of continuous combat, women were more fully integrated into all facets of the armed forces than ever before. Even so, the special operations community was still overwhelmingly male. As such, pilots supporting operators on the ground had long ago learned the value of passing communication duties to their female counterparts during tense engagements. Nothing gets the attention of a distracted male brain quite like a female voice. Speaking of distracted brains, in the excitement of fighting for his life and tending to Jad, Kerry realized that he'd completely forgotten about the F-15s and their bellies full of small diameter bombs. Keying the radio, Kerry was preparing to transmit the wave-off brevity code when he had a wild thought. Maybe there was something he could do for the crazy American after all. Skillful 2-3, this is Reaper 7, Kerry said. Change of mission. I say again, change of mission. Stand by for new instructions. Over. This is Skillful. Send it over. Gathering his thoughts, Kerry pressed the transmit button and began to speak. Chapter 78. Jack was surprised by how helpless he felt as the rifle slipped from his fingers. He didn't normally measure his well-being by the weapon he carried, but there was something to be said for the security offered by the AK's worn wooden stock, especially in comparison to what his fingers felt now. Nothing. Turn around, just as slowly. For the first time since he'd been jabbed in the thigh with a syringe full of ketamine, Jack felt a bit of satisfaction when he saw his tormentors face to face. The normally cool and collected VC manager looked decidedly less so. Dark splotches coated his sleeves, and his hands were covered with partially congealed blood. While he hadn't been nearly crucified, the man's wild eyes and unkempt hair seemed to suggest that he wasn't having such a great day either. The waitress turned executioner didn't look any the worse for wear, but she no longer oozed sex appeal. Her cheeks were flushed, and her eyes shone with what looked like a barely contained mania. Unlike her partner, the Russian wasn't covered in dried blood, but her blouse had a spattering of incriminatingly rust-colored flecks. I'm glad you found me, Jack said, projecting his voice for the phone in his shirt. Why? The Russian said. Because it saved me the trouble of searching this compound inch by inch to find the two of you. Tell me the location of the scientist and her son, and I'll let you walk away. You'll let us, the Russian said with a laugh. You're alone, with no weapon and one arm. I'm not too worried. Then you're a fool, Jack said. Trust me when I say that you don't want me as an enemy. Tell me where they are. Last chance. The waitress snarled, and Jack turned to face her, which is why he was completely unprepared for what happened next. With the speed of a striking viper, her boyfriend lunged, smacking Jack across the skull with his pistol. The weapon's front sight post furrowed the side of Jack's head, tearing open the flesh from his ear almost to his temple. Jack growled, squaring off with the man, but he'd already moved beyond Jack's reach. Enough, the man said. We're leaving, and you're driving. Your American friends will be much less trigger-happy with you at the wheel. Get in the Humvee and start the engine. Now. No, Jack said, pressing his good hand against his aching skull. Head wounds were notorious bleeders, and he could already feel a wet stream snaking down his cheek. Kill him, the waitress said. I'll drive. And then the sky split in two. Chapter 79. The sky didn't actually split in two, but it felt that way to Jack's aching head. One moment he was facing down two gunmen. The next he was lying flat on his back, contemplating the flawlessly blue sky. But that wasn't quite true. Four objects marred the otherwise perfect view. Swept-wing aircraft with twin columns of fire lancing from their engines. Jack had never been on the receiving end of a sonic boom before, and his tired body thought that stretching out on the hard soil for a spell was a fine idea. But there was no rest for the wicked. Rolling away from the prone forms of the Iranian and the Russian, Jack grabbed for his rifle. His fingers had just touched the scarred wood when bullets snapped into the ground, raising dirt plumes inches from his face. Abandoning the AK, Jack continued to roll, sliding beneath a Humvee as rounds sparked off its metal frame. Scrambling to his hands and knees, Jack put as much of the armored 3-ton vehicle between himself and his attackers as possible. While he hadn't anticipated a flight of F-15s buzzing past at supersonic speeds,
Jack had been hoping for a distraction of some sort. He'd left the line to Mr. C open for a reason, and it appeared that Gavin and the intrepid John Clark had come through yet again. When Jack made it home to Virginia, he might just take the Cyber Ninja up on his long-standing invitation to play a round of Call of Duty. At the very least, he'd buy the hacker a case of Mountain Dew and a carton of Twinkies. With a sortie of F-15s overhead, a special operations team outside the compound, and two angry operatives trying to kill him, Jack decided it was past time to establish communications with the outside world. Duck walking away from the Hummers, he scurried toward the looming Russian scout car. The BRDM was about double the size of a Humvee and much more heavily armored. It would make a great place to hide while he picked up where he'd left off with Mr. C. But when he reached for his phone, Jack's fingers patted empty fabric. It must have fallen out of his pocket. Still, things weren't all bad. As per the bloodstains on their clothing, the Iranian and Russian must not have been on great terms with the compound's occupants either. With Americans outside and angry Syrians inside, Jack's tormentors were trapped between a rock and a hard place. If Jack could find his phone, he'd have the kidnappers exactly where he wanted them. But the sound of a Humvee roaring to life suggested otherwise. Chapter 80. The throaty diesel rumble changed to a full-fledged growl as the Hummer lumbered away from the motor pool. His friends were leaving the party, which meant that his only link to Becca and Tommy was disappearing in a cloud of fumes. Jack was about to retrace his steps in favor of stealing a Humvee of his own when a series of engines cranked over behind him. Turning, he swore. The platoon of suicide bombers was now in their respective vehicles. Apparently, the low-flying fighters had galvanized more than just Jack to action. The prayer leader was standing at the front of the gate, waving the first car forward. Jack had seen the aftermath of VBIED explosions and knew that the victims were just as likely to be women and children as soldiers. Letting those 12 vehicles escape would be the equivalent of emptying a bucket full of rattlesnakes into a kindergarten classroom. If there was any way he could prevent the human cruise missiles from wreaking the death and destruction they intended, Jack knew he had to try. Turning back to the BRDM, Jack scaled its metal frame as he formulated a plan. As plans went, it wasn't great, but it would have to do. Chapter 81. Unlike the original design put into service by the Soviet Union, this version of the venerable four-wheeled BRDM-2 armored personnel carrier had been modified extensively. In keeping with the same entrepreneurial spirit that had first prompted jihadis to mount machine guns or recoilless rifles to Hilux pickup trucks, the BRDM's standard turret had been completely removed. In its place sat a formidable weapon. Jack didn't know the nomenclature for the quad-barreled anti-aircraft gun, and he didn't care. What he did know was that the contraption used old-school traversing and elevation mechanisms, powered by hand cranks instead of vehicle hydraulics. Even better, the ammunition cans were already mounted next to the guns. While the anti-aircraft system wasn't anything Jack had ever encountered, the weapon at its heart was a variant of the Soviet-era KPV heavy machine gun, which had seen widespread use in one configuration or another since World War II. Once you understood the basics of how they operated, machine gun variants weren't all that terribly different from one another. After examining the weapon, Jack quickly found and actioned the charging mechanism. Then it was simply a matter of cranking the easy-to-spin traversing and elevation wheels to bring the weapon's sight onto target. Or at least it would have been easy to spin them with two hands. With just one, Jack was forced to crank the elevation mechanism first and then reach across his body to spin the traversing wheel. His jerky adjustments didn't make for a smooth walk of the iron sights onto target, but since he was shooting at a convoy of stationary cars instead of fast-moving airplanes or helicopters, his method of aiming should work. Should being the operative word. After switching between the wheels twice, he'd finally centered the crude iron sights onto the first vehicle queuing to leave the motor pool.
Then Jack stepped on the fire control pedal with his left foot. The guns didn't so much shoot as erupt. Between the gouts of flame and jackhammer-like pounding, Jack thought one of the vintage weapons might have exploded. Releasing the pedal, Jack peered over the front of the machine gun's conical flash suppressors to survey his work. Destruction awaited. But not the destruction he'd been trying to achieve. The quads had fired low, and while several vehicles were now on fire, they'd been parked between him and his targets. The gaggle of VBIEDs were untouched. Grabbing the elevation wheel, Jack cranked just as the first VBIED, a Kia, rolled free of the enclosure and made a run for it. Jack centered his sight picture on the car's hood and hammered the firing pedal. This time he was prepared for the muzzle flash and was able to look above the fireballs produced by the quads as four streams of emerald tracers converged on the unlucky vehicle. Golf ball-sized projectiles pounded the car, tossing chunks of metal into the air as the armor-piercing bullets shredded the vehicle's thin skin. A moment later, the car dissolved into a teeth-rattling explosion as one of the incendiary rounds found the car's sinister payload. Ducking as falling metal pinged against the BRDM's armored hull, Jack stomped the firing pedal again as he spun the elevation and traversing wheels, walking the stream of bullets across the line of waiting cars. The ensuing explosions tossed him against the gun's unforgiving metal as shockwaves buffeted the BRDM. The enclosure once housing the suicide vehicles now resembled the gates of hell. Flames billowed from behind the chain-link fence, boiling across the ground in hazy waves. The heat hit Jack like a blast furnace as thick, choking smoke poured skyward, carrying the acrid smells of burning rubber and gasoline. The sprinkling of debris falling from the sky turned into a full-fledged downpour. A section of metal as long as his forearm clanged against the quad, just inches from Jack's fingers, and he decided this was his exit cue. The roiling black smoke from the VBIED inferno was curling over the BRDM, and Jack now had the entire compound's attention. Random pieces of the car were no longer the only metallic objects pinging off the BRDM's armor plating. A ricochet bounced off the ammo box to Jack's left, denting the metal before whining past his head. Cursing, Jack looked into the inviting crew compartment beneath his feet but resisted the urge to hunker down. The armored crew space was more than capable of fending off small-caliber rounds. It wasn't connected to the driver's station. Taking a breath, Jack leapt from where he was crouching behind the quad guns and half-rolled, half-slid over the flat ledge separating the turret from the sloped edge leading to the driver's hatch. On his first attempt, Jack slid too far and found himself spread-eagle across the thick glass that served as the driver's viewport. Rolling to his side, Jack scrambled back up the ledge just as a bullet smacked into the section of glass on which he'd been lying. Pushed off the hull, he slithered into the driver's compartment head first, nearly braining himself on a toolbox. After pulling his feet in behind him, Jack pushed the toolbox out of the way and folded his 6-foot-plus frame into the dusty canvas seat. Then he surveyed the instrument console. As he should have expected, the gauges and buttons were all labeled in Cyrillic. But this wasn't a showstopper. The BRDM was an armored car with a standard gasoline engine, not a next-generation stealth fighter. Like most military vehicles, there was no ignition key. Instead, he just needed to turn on the battery power and find the ignition. Simple. Outside, the steady ping-ping-ping of small arms rounds slamming against the BRDM's armor plating sounded like the ticking of a doomsday clock. Scanning the console for a battery switch, Jack noticed something unexpected. A length of chain was looped around the steering wheel and padlocked to the vehicle's metal frame, preventing the steering wheel from turning. So much for simple. Chapter 82. Ignoring the chain for the moment, Jack concentrated on something he could control, the battery switch. Even though the BRDM had first entered service long before Jack was born, the dashboard was still a bit intimidating. Gauges covered with Cyrillic letters sat side by side with darkened lights and buttons of indeterminable purposes. The gear shift, gas and brake pedals, and steering wheel were easily identifiable, but the rest was a mystery. Peering across the sea of dials and switches, Jack found a push button that reminded him of the ignition on his father's old lawn tractor. Jack thumbed the rubber housing, but nothing happened. Power first, then ignition. He flipped several switches at random as the metal hailstorm grew louder. A second examination of the instrument cluster yielded similar results. Lots of interesting switches and dials, but nothing that brought power to the lifeless needles and lights. For a heart-stopping moment, Jack considered whether the battery was even connected. Just as quickly, he pushed the idea away. If the battery was gone, he was dead in the water. Instead of dwelling on what-ifs, Jack tried to put himself into the minds of the vehicle's designers. Russian weapons weren't known for user comfort. A Western driver expected to find everything needed to operate the machine at his fingertips. Not so with Russians. Jack needed to think like a Russian. Twisting, Jack looked above and behind the driver's seat. More levers, knobs, and dials, but nothing that supplied power. In an act of desperation, Jack turned completely around. Then he saw it. A solitary switch. With a whispered prayer, Jack grabbed the metal nub between his fingers and pushed it upward. An audible click echoed through the driver's station, followed by a familiar buzz. Electricity. Turning back to the dashboard, Jack saw a Christmas tree of lights and flickering needles. Leaning forward, Jack reached for the starter button. And that was when the RPG detonated. Chapter 83. To be fair, it took Jack a moment to diagnose the source of the ear-splitting explosion that tossed him like a rag doll across the driver's station. His first thought was that applying battery power had somehow sparked an explosion, but the blast's magnitude put that notion to rest. An electrical short in a vehicle this old wasn't out of the question, but it would have caused a fire first, then an explosion. The more likely explanation was that his attackers had just upped the ante. Crawling back to the driver's seat, Jack stabbed the ignition button. The engine turned over, but it didn't catch. Running through a litany of curses that would have impressed his father and horrified his mother, Jack pumped the gas, trying to ignore the choking smoke drifting into the cabin. On the fifth pump, Jack again jabbed the ignition button. This time, the engine caught with a thunderous roar. Slamming the transmission into drive, Jack floored the gas. The BRDM shuddered, lurching forward like a drunken elephant. In a bit of good news, the air flowing in through the open hatches helped keep the smoke at bay. On the not-so-positive side, the metal behind Jack's seat was getting warmer, and the steering wheel was still chained to the vehicle's frame. A snatch of a country song came to mind. If you're going through hell, keep on going. Jack agreed wholeheartedly with the sentiment, but felt like the singer had left out some salient points. Like what to do when hell was following right behind you. Chapter 84. Coughing against the thickening smoke, Jack eased the steering wheel to the right, straining it against the limit imposed by the chain and padlock. Setting aside the question of why a compound surrounded by 15-foot walls also needed vehicle locks, Jack concentrated on a more immediate problem: steering. In this department, he was actually doing better than he'd hoped. While the length of chain prevented any drastic manipulations of the steering wheel, whoever had last secured the links hadn't pulled them taut before engaging the padlock. As such, Jack had a bit of give before hitting the limits imposed by the length of steel. But not much. Gripping the steering wheel, Jack pulled to the left, straining against the chain while bracing himself for impact. A second later, his right front bumper smashed against a sand-filled HESCO barrier. The impact almost threw Jack from his seat, pinballing his left shoulder against the unforgiving metal frame. Even so, he considered the agony radiating from his damaged arm a fair price to pay once he'd resettled himself behind the driver's viewport. Like a game of high-stakes bumper cars, Jack had discovered a way to capitalize on the vehicle's mass and speed by using the multiple obstacles in his path to provide gross adjustments to his steerage. It wasn't an exact science, but Jack was able to keep the armored car roughly on course despite the steering wheel's limited play. Roughly. The compound's exit loomed in front of Jack like the mouth of some prehistoric shark. Anti-vehicle barriers deployed waist-high from the concrete resembled jagged teeth, while strands of concertina wire dangled across the entry like bits of seaweed. Gunning the gas, Jack took the BRDM to ramming speed as he bore down on the entrance. The men guarding the gate decided that living to fight another day beat martyrdom. While both guards sprayed the BRDM with automatic rifle fire, they also retreated to sandbag-reinforced bunkers on either side of the entrance. Jack's escape route was clear, with the exception of the fire hydrant-like anti-vehicle barriers that had just deployed from the ground. With the accelerator pressed all the way to the floor and the BRDM's engine redlining, Jack figured he had a 50-50 chance of plowing his way through the intimidating structures. Presumably, the devices had been installed to keep the riffraff out rather than the compound's occupants in. With this in mind, it stood to reason that if the barriers were reinforced, they were structurally strongest when repelling attacks from outside the compound. In theory, but theory tended to become a bit abstract when the rubber met the road and bullets were flying. As if to punctuate Jack's thought, a large caliber round thudded into the driver's viewport, spiderwebbing the already cracked surface. The armored glass held, but Jack reflexively jerked the wheel to the right. The chain kept his overreaction from completely taking the vehicle off course, but the damage was done. Instead of the single barrier he'd been hoping to power through, the BRDM's grill was now centered between two of the stubby contraptions. Fantastic. With less than 50 feet remaining, Jack could try to adjust course and sacrifice speed, or just hang on and hope for the best. Neither option was great, so Jack split the difference. Keeping the gas pedal flush against the floor, Jack nudged the steering wheel a fraction of an inch to the left and prayed. Then steel met steel at 60 kilometers per hour. Chapter 85. This time the collision didn't jar Jack so much as attempt to dislodge his teeth from his gums. Even though he'd braced himself against the steering wheel with his one good arm and the vehicle's floor with his left leg, he still headbutted the metal frame with admirable vigor. Unsurprisingly, the frame won. Jack's vision blurred as a supernova of pain exploded across his skull. Shaking his aching head to clear the fuzziness, Jack sent a splattering of blood across the dusty dashboard. But his new head wound was the least of his worries. He was more concerned with the high-pitched shriek of metal grating against metal. That, and the sudden lack of forward motion. A quick glance through the viewport told Jack everything. While he'd managed to dodge the rightmost vehicle barrier, the one to the left was wedged under the BRDM's hull. At some point during the crash sequence, the horrific impact had knocked Jack's foot clear of the accelerator. Pulling himself back into the driver's seat one-handed, Jack stomped on the pedal. The engine raged, and the vehicle rocked forward, but the barrier held. He wasn't going anywhere. Releasing the gas, Jack let the BRDM settle and then jammed the accelerator to the floor, rocking the vehicle back and forth. With each oscillation, the banshee wailing of bending metal grew more pronounced, but the stubborn barrier refused to give. The slew of curses Jack let fly this time would have given even his Marine father pause. He'd been crucified, drugged, shot with an RPG, and left for dead twice. His vehicle was on fire, and a hornet's nest of pissed-off jihadis were hosing down the BRDM with crew-served weapons. Undoubtedly, some of the bravest of the bunch were chucking grenades at the vehicle's open hatches. All this, and it was a vehicle barrier that was going to stop him? Not today. The vehicle shuddered and Jack slipped sideways. Reaching for a handhold to steady himself, he mistakenly yanked a stray lever. In response, hydraulics groaned and part of the vehicle's forward hull shifted downward. Standing in the cramped cockpit, Jack ignored the bullets flattening themselves against the crumbling glass as he peered over the front of the BRDM, trying to understand what had just happened. The armored vehicle's profile had changed. For some reason, the hull was now canted downward. Then he understood. "Well, son of a bitch," Jack said. The BRDM was actually amphibious. Accordingly, the vehicle's leading edge was hydraulically actuated like a bulldozer's blade so that the driver could adjust the BRDM's hydrodynamic profile in order to give the lumbering beast greater stability in rough waters. Grabbing the same lever, Jack wrenched it from the midway position all the way down and gassed the engine. For a terrifying moment, the BRDM tilted skyward as the vehicle barrier bore the hydraulic force exerted by the lower splash guard with the same stoicism it had handled the rocking vehicle. Then the shriek of steel climaxed into a crunch that rocked the armored car from stem to stern. A heartbeat later, the waist-high tires caught pavement, and the BRDM rocketed from the compound's entrance like a cannonball. He was free. But the world outside the compound wasn't exactly all peace and serenity. Tracer fire arced from the compound's walls in sinuous emerald tentacles as impacting artillery rounds raised clouds of dust and destruction. To his left, a pair of muzzle flashes were winking from what appeared to be a compromised hold site, while two GMV special operations vehicles in overwatch positions poured supporting fire from crew-served weapons. But fireworks aside, it was the familiar object to his front that held Jack's attention. The Humvee. The boxy vehicle had run off the gravel path leading from the compound and down an embankment. Now it was fishtailing its way back up, spewing a rooster tail of gravel and dirt. Surprisingly, the Hummer didn't seem to be drawing fire. Or maybe not so surprisingly. The American attackers were probably loath to fire on one of their own vehicles, while the compound's defenders likewise considered the Hummer a friendly. Even so, the Humvee didn't seem to have made it through the battle scot-free. The right rear tire was shedding tread in great flapping chunks. The rubber at the tire's core seemed to be intact, but the loss of traction was affecting the vehicle's stability. The Humvee summited the embankment, but swerved from one side of the road to the other as the driver fought to keep the vehicle from pitching back down the levee. Jack had no such worries. He poured on the gas, bearing down on the struggling vehicle like a charging rhinoceros, while ignoring the thickening smoke and heat radiating from the compartment behind him. The RPG-ignited fire wasn't going to just go away. In fact, it was probably even money whether the hungry flames reached the vehicle's fuel cell before he caught up with the Humvee. But Jack put the pedal to the metal all the same, careening toward the oscillating vehicle. Like a cougar preparing to pounce, Jack felt the BRDM gather itself before surging toward the crippled Hummer. As the distance between the two vehicles shrank, Jack had a single disconcerting thought. He was going to miss. Chapter 86. Jack was steering the cumbersome armored car with a deftness that bordered on the supernatural, considering the circumstances. But the closer he grew to the Hummer, the more accurately he needed to steer. The chain had other ideas. Every time he attempted to make a larger steering correction, the chain snapped tight, thwarting his efforts. Try as he might, Jack couldn't match his target's unpredictable gyrations. The best he could do was aim straight down the center of the road in an effort to thread the needle between the Hummer's side-to-side oscillations. While this was a great plan to close distance, it didn't offer the precision needed to ram the Humvee. One sharp turn, and Jack would drive right by. Straight lines he could manage, but the dexterity required to hit a moving target was beyond his ability. The Hummer grew steadily closer as something about the notion of straight lines bounced around Jack's brain, refusing to be ignored. Straight lines. Straight lines. Then he had it. Keeping the accelerator mashed to the floor, Jack released the wheel, allowing the chain to provide the tension required to keep the wheel straight. Then he reached across the cabin for the toolbox he'd shoved out of the way what seemed like an eternity ago. At first,
He tried to stretch from a seated position so that he could keep his eyes on the road. But after twice brushing the pitted metal with his fingertips without securing a handhold, Jack gave up. If what he was planning had a prayer of succeeding, he'd have to quit watching the road at some point. Might as well be now. Abandoning the viewport, Jack turned parallel to the floor, stretching for everything he was worth. His probing fingers touched the toolbox's handle and then slipped away when the BRDM hit a pothole. Cursing, Jack tried again, for the first time releasing pressure on the gas pedal in order to increase his reach. The BRDM decelerated, but this time Jack touched metal. Dragging the dense container to his seat set Jack's core on fire, but he ignored the pain. After a second of grunting and even more cursing, he had the box where he wanted it. Now came the moment of truth. Reaching down, Jack grabbed the handle and attempted to one-arm curl the unwieldy box onto his lap. He failed. Miserably. The box slid to the floor, spilling tools across the compartment. Jack looked at the debris and then decided that, since he couldn't get the box up to his lap one-handed, maybe the lighter load was a blessing in disguise. Hoisting the box onto his legs, Jack got his first look back out the viewport. The Humvee was less than 20 feet away. It was now or never. With another grunt, Jack slid the toolbox from his lap to his right knee. Then he bent forward and lowered the container onto the gas pedal. It worked. Sort of. The toolbox kept the accelerator depressed, but not flat against the floor. Without Jack's foot keeping the accelerator floored, the armored car was slowing down. No matter. So was Jack. With a final adjustment to the steering wheel, Jack stood on the driver's seat and boosted himself onto the BRDM's roof. What he saw when his head cleared the armor plating brought new meaning to out of the frying pan and into the fire. Chapter 87. All Reaper elements, Reaper 6 is RP Tango. I say again, Reaper 6 is RP Tango. Over. With a final check on Jad, Carey grabbed his rifle and popped his head out of his hole, feeling very much like a prairie dog exposing himself with a hawk circling overhead. Fortunately, the rest of Triple Nickel was doing the same, as every weapon system the ODA team possessed began to continuously pump steel onto target. Carey could hear the deep thump-thump-thump of MK-19 grenade launchers, joined by the throaty hammering of 50-caliber machine guns. Shells whistled overhead as Brian's 120mm mortars made their presence known, while the unmistakable chattering of saws and M4s going cyclic filled the air. The effects were awe-inspiring. The weapons fire from the compound slackened to a trickle as munitions impacted the length and width of the fortress's walls, sending eruptions of dirt and stone skyward. But this awesome display of precious firepower wasn't what garnered Carey's attention. Instead, he was focused on the two vehicles careening his way. One was a Humvee sliding from one side of the road to the other. The second was even more interesting. A BRDM. A BRDM in flames with a man standing on the roof. Reaper 6, this is Reaper 7, Carey said. We've got a problem. Chapter 88. The rear of the BRDM was on fire. Not the kind of on fire that meant a curtain of smoke punctuated by flames poking up here and there. No, this was the kind of on-fire Baptist preachers thundered about on Sunday mornings. Sheets of flame billowed from the crew compartment, framed by columns of choking black smoke thick enough to taste. If not for the feeble headwind provided by the vehicle's forward motion, Jack thought he would have succumbed then and there. But he did not asphyxiate on the roof of the BRDM, which meant he had to deal with phase two of his plan. The Humvee swerving back and forth just feet away. The Humvee edged out of the rolling smoke enclosing the BRDM like a phantasm materializing in the early morning fog. One moment there had been nothing but the gravel road passing by at a ridiculous pace. The next, the Hummer's pitted desert-colored frame loomed to his left, almost close enough to touch. But before Jack could react, the Humvee vanished, swallowed again by the churning smoke. Cursing. Jack edged as far forward on the roof as he dared. His eyes watered from the acrid fumes and his skin reddened from the heat. But he saw the Humvee's frame just ahead. The Hummer was one of the turtleback variants, meaning that rather than rear windows, the back half of the vehicle was a single piece of angled metal. The structure sloped from the turret opening on the roof down to the rear bumper, resembling a ramp of sorts. Before he could think through the insanity of what he intended, Jack shuffled backward until the heat became unbearable, and then sprinted the length of the BRDM's roof. When he got to the edge, Jack leapt into space, his legs bicycling, his good arm windmilling. For what seemed like an eternity, he sailed through emptiness, wind whistling past his face and nothing but air beneath his feet. Then the Humvee appeared, like a rust-spattered steel wall. Jack sucked in a breath before smashing into the angled armor plating, instinctively reaching out with his left hand to cushion the impact. Mistake. Pain radiated the length of his arm, and Jack gave voice to the agony in a lung-bursting scream. He reached for a handhold on the Humvee's canted back as he slid down the sloped metal toward the treacherously churning rear tires. Grasping for support, Jack's fingers closed around a length of flexible steel. He gripped the metal rod like a pit bull. Looking up, Jack realized that he'd snared the vehicle's whip antenna, the top of which was tied off to the Humvee's bumper. Or at least, it had been tied off. Apparently, radio aerials weren't designed to hold 220-pound men. The antenna bowed dangerously downward, resembling the fishing pole of a weekend angler who'd hooked a great white rather than a perch. Jack slid slowly lower in response, edging ever closer to road. He tried to use his left hand, but the damaged arm gave way under the strain. He couldn't pull himself up, and he couldn't stay where he was. He was screwed. Turning, Jack saw a steel mesh storage platform about even with his waist. The small enclosure appeared to have been spot welded to the Hummer's frame, probably to provide space for an extra can of diesel or perhaps additional ammo cans. Regardless of what the designers had intended, Jack thought the steel lattice looked like heaven. Wrenching downward on the antenna, Jack tried to swing his left leg onto the platform. Another mistake. The antenna bowed under the strain, dropping Jack so that his right foot brushed the ground. He screamed as the speeding gravel tried to wrench him from the vehicle and curled both knees to his chest. Something popped in his shoulder. His right hand had slid the length of the antenna as he'd fallen, and now his fingers found the aerial's wider base. Grasping the broader attachment, Jack wrenched himself toward the Hummer with a burst of adrenaline-fueled strength as he again swung his left foot toward the metal grating. This time, his boot wedged inside the compartment. With a move that would have done a contortionist proud, Jack rotated his body toward the Humvee, locking his left leg out while struggling to find purchase on the slanted surface with his right. For a heartbeat, Jack's right leg banged impotently against the Hummer as his strength ebbed. Then, in a moment of desperation, Jack pushed off with his left leg, lunging upward and grabbing the antenna by its treacherous middle. Again the metal bowed, but this time Jack was ready. The moment his upper body was vertical, he hooked his right leg onto the platform next to his left. Shuddering with the effort, Jack pressed himself upright. With both legs settled beneath him, Jack had a modicum of stability, but suddenly the fickle whip antenna flexed outward, away from the Humvee. In the blink of an eye, Jack was rotating backward with nothing to arrest his motion but his throbbing shoulder and overworked stomach muscles. He was tipping over like a fool trying to balance a chair on one leg. He made a grab for the antenna's base. It wasn't enough. He was falling. Until the BRDM exploded. The fireball pummeled Jack, singeing his clothes and blistering his skin. But the accompanying blast wave made the pain worthwhile. One moment he was wavering against the back of the Humvee. The next, he was plastered against the sloping metal frame like a bug on a windshield. Ignoring his screaming body and smoking clothes, Jack reached up, grabbing for the Hummer's gun turret. He snagged a metal handhold and pulled his body flush against the Humvee's canted side while bracing his feet in the wire mesh. For a long moment,
He just held himself in place, taking breath after shuddering breath. Then he widened his stance, wedging his feet into the corners of the platform. As he stood on the back of a Humvee hurtling across the desert, Jack had just one thought. It was time to end this. Chapter 89. The Humvee's occupants were both armed, and as far as Jack knew, still had the full use of both hands. But that was fine. Jack lacked finesse, wasn't much of a tactician, and acted impetuously. All of that was true. What was also true was that Jack possessed something harder to quantify, something visceral. Jack was a hammer, and the Hummer had two nails that needed pounding. After visualizing what he was going to do, Jack swung inside the Hummer through the turret's circular opening and went to war. Leading with his right foot, Jack connected with the waitress's head, just as his leg reached full extension. The sickening sound of his boot crunching against her skull was second only to the thud of her face rebounding off the bulletproof glass. Based on the way she limply slid to the floor, she was out of the fight. Her boyfriend, not so much. Whether the man had seen Jack in time to react, or had been in the process of correcting for the Humvee's unsteady handling when Jack attacked, the result was the same. He jerked the wheel to the left just as Jack swung into the cabin, and the inertia sent Jack tumbling into the rear seats. No matter. Jack spun toward the driver, torquing his hips as he swung his massive right hand. This wasn't anything as civilized as a boxing match, or even a sparring session on the jiu-jitsu mats. This was the proverbial fight in the elevator, and nobody did cornered junkyard dog better than Jack. Well, almost nobody. Jack's hammer fist was millimeters from the driver's inviting right ear when he slammed on the brakes. Jack crashed into the sturdy seatbacks, bashing his still bleeding forehead against another uncushioned section of metal sheeting before tumbling to the floor. In keeping with his fantastic luck, Jack landed on his left arm and the flesh ripped open even farther. The electric jolt filled his eyes with tears. Pushing himself up from the metal floorboards with his good hand, Jack found himself face to face with the business end of a pistol. Knowing that the gun was too far away for him to grab, Jack did the next best thing. He channeled his inner hammer. With a grunt, Jack delivered the mother of all elbow strikes to the back of the driver's seat. He pictured the point of his bone spearing through the canvas seat and cleaving the driver's spinal cord in half. While he didn't achieve all that, Jack did manage to make the man miss when he fired his pistol. Mostly. The ricocheting round slammed into Jack's left shoulder with the force of a baseball bat. Ignoring the numbness spreading down his arm, Jack grabbed the man's gun wrist with his good hand and wrenched downward, using the seat back as a fulcrum. The pistol clattered to the floor. The man leaned over the seat, firing a jab at Jack's head. Jack met the punch with his forehead and heard the delightful sound of knuckles breaking. Now they each had just one hand. But Jack was meaner. Releasing the driver's wrist, Jack grabbed a handful of his shirt and jerked him forward while administering a second headbutt. Jack had been aiming for the man's nose, but hit his mouth instead. No matter. The effect was the same. Blood flowed and bones broke. Apparently deciding that he'd had enough, the driver opened the Hummer's door and bailed. Jack grabbed the fallen pistol and then shouldered open the rear door. He half fell, half crawled out of the vehicle, landing flat on his back. Through the smoky haze, he saw a convoy of trucks racing toward him, led by an MRZR sporting a machine gun. The gunner situated in the all-terrain vehicle's passenger seat unleashed a torrent of fire over Jack's head at the compound behind him. A moment later, the fighters manning the crew-served weapons in the GMVs trailing the MRZR joined in the fray, pummeling the compound's fighting positions with ordnance. The cavalry had arrived, which meant that Jack needed to wrap things up. Turning onto his side, he centered the pistol's sights on the fleeing Iranian and fired twice. The second round blew out the Iranian's knee in a mass of blood and bone splinters, and the spy tumbled to the ground. Ignoring the approaching convoy, Jack limped over to the driver and stuck his pistol in the man's face. "Tell me where the scientist is," Jack said, "now." "No," the man answered. "You can't—" Jack drove the muzzle into the driver's shoulder and pulled the trigger. The spy screamed as flecks of spittle coated his lips. "Tell me," Jack said. "You're an American," he said. "You won't—" This time, it was the ruined knee. The driver fainted. Jack backhanded him across the face. On the second slap, the man's eyes opened. "I have 10 more rounds," Jack said, "and I swear to God I'll blow off your pecker next. Where is she?" The driver moaned, but he told Jack what he knew. They always did. Epilogue. The helicopters came in hot, flaring mere feet above the tarmac. The downdraft sandblasted Jack with grit and dirt, but he didn't mind. Choppers that came in fast equated to happy pilots. Happy pilots meant a successful mission. At least that's what he was hoping. The Israeli defense minister had offered to let Jack watch the action in real time from a seat next to her in the high-tech command post, but he'd declined. He couldn't stomach the thought of sitting impotently by as strangers attempted to rescue people he cared about. Besides, Jack had more than just Becca and Tommy on his mind. One of the Green Berets who'd helped to rescue him was about to undergo a second round of surgery. If there was a better place to pray for divine intervention than an Israeli flight line while watching a crescent moon rise over the ocean, Jack couldn't think of one. "Pilots only fly crazy after a successful mission," Dudu said, echoing Jack's thoughts. "We'll see," Jack said. Though if anyone had a chance of bringing Becca and Tommy back alive, it would be the two helicopters full of rough men who'd departed hours earlier. In a show of solidarity, the assault force had numbered 22 shooters, 11 from Sayeret Matkal and 11 from SEAL Team 6, the quick reactionary force dispatched from the States the previous day. From Jack's vantage point during the pre-mission briefing, neither unit seemed terribly happy to be working with the other. But at the end of the day, the military does what politicians say. And both Jack's father and the Israeli Prime Minister wanted to send a message to the people who'd kidnapped Becca and Tommy. The President of the United States wanted the organization to know that the act of kidnapping Americans carried with it lethal consequences. The government of Israel wanted the Wagner mercenaries to understand that operating on Israeli soil was not conducive to a long life and happiness. Jack was hoping that both messages had been received loud and clear. The Blackhawks taxied up to the edge of the tarmac, their landing lights lancing through the darkness. "Come on," Dudu said. Jack hesitated for a moment, remembering the explicit instructions he'd received about the harm that would befall his person if he stepped over the double red line denoting the boundary between the tarmac and the flight line proper. Then he ignored them. While the gunshot wound he'd sustained during the aborted insertion necessitated a sling, Dudu still radiated an aura of barely controlled menace. Air Force security personnel were notorious for enforcing flight line protocol, but Jack had his money on the Shin Bet officer. Following in the stout man's wake, Jack made his way to the helicopters as their blades spun down. Jack was now sporting his own sling, and he had to wonder what the disembarking passengers thought of the two observers waiting in the darkness. A wail cut through the night air. Jack looked over his shoulder and swore as he saw flashing red and orange lights. "Ambulance," Dudu said, tracking the vehicle's progress. "Not good." The ambulance screeched to a halt just outside the lead helicopter's rotor disc, and a pair of paramedics exploded out the rear doors, pushing a gurney between them. Apparently, there were other reasons helicopters came in hot. Two men exited the Black Hawk, supporting a third between them. The paramedics rushed to meet the gaggle, lifting the wounded operator onto the gurney before the scrum of five headed for the waiting ambulance at a run.
Jack intended to hang back in case there were additional injured shooters, but Dudu was having none of it. Squaring his shoulders, the Shin Bet officer headed for the closest helicopter, barking questions in Hebrew at anyone who would listen. Jack started to follow and then stopped, directing his attention to the second bird, which was also disembarking passengers. Though it had been billed as a joint operation, the assault team had flown in helicopters segregated by nationality. This was probably due mostly to operational considerations, but it was also symbolic of the state of the two nations' relationship. Israel was still deeply angry that the United States had run an unsanctioned operation on its soil, while the Americans were singularly unimpressed with Israel's operational security, particularly the Shin Bet. While the initial debriefings with the Iranian spy were far from conclusive, the consensus now seemed to be that there was no mole. Instead, the Shin Bet's hardened computer network had been penetrated in much the same manner as the Iron Dome's air-gapped systems. Apparently, Israel wasn't the only nation capable of pulling off daring intelligence operations. In any case, while the joint rescue operation was a good start, there was still much work to be done. That said, Jack had a feeling that fences were already being mended. Apparently, an American F-35 pilot had sacrificed her life saving Tel Aviv from the Iranian cruise missiles. The account of her heroic actions was playing endlessly on both Israeli and American television. Accordingly, social media was ablaze with heartfelt messages exchanged between ordinary American and Israeli citizens. It didn't take a diplomat to understand that when the people of two nations thought highly of each other, their politicians would fall in line. But the international issues at play were way above Jack's pay grade. Instead, he was singularly focused on the figures exiting the Black Hawk. The first two were kitted-up operators with the prerequisite broad shoulders, long hair, and furry beards that marked them either as Vikings or as members of the veneral SEAL Team 6. But after three more of their kind hopped onto the tarmac, two seemingly out-of-place silhouettes followed. Abandoning all decorum, Jack sprinted for the helicopter just as the pair walked into the pool of light cast by the Black Hawk's landing light. "Becca," Jack said. "Tommy." Becca turned toward the sound of her name. Seeing Jack, she pulled him into a hug. "You didn't forget us," Becca said, releasing her embrace. "I knew you'd come." "Not me," Jack said with a laugh as he held up his sling. "But some friends of mine were able to lend a hand. You okay?" Becca gave a slow nod. "They didn't hurt us. But it was awful, Jack. Awful. When the rescue happened, I wanted the men who took us to die. I wanted it with all of my heart. But it was still awful." "I know," Jack said. "Believe me, I know. But in time, the memories will fade." Disentangling himself from Becca, Jack squatted in front of Tommy. "How you doing, buddy?" Jack said. As usual, Tommy's gaze was focused on the ground. But at the sound of Jack's voice, the little boy took a step closer. "Hey," Jack said, "I've got something for you." Reaching into his pocket, Jack withdrew a new Captain America figure and placed it into Tommy's hand. Again, the child was silent, but his fingers wrapped around the figure with an intensity that turned his knuckles white. "Dr. Schweigart, if you'll come with me, please." Becca looked from the SEAL who'd materialized out of the night to Jack, a questioning expression on her face. "It's okay," Jack said. "They've got some things they need to ask you." "I'm sure they do," Becca said. "Thank you for everything." The unassuming scientist with the knowledge to potentially upset the world's balance of power gave Jack another violent hug. Then she was walking away, her son in tow. Jack watched the little family until they vanished into the night. Then he took his new phone from his pocket and made a call. "Lizanne? Hi. It's Jack. This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tom Clancy, Target Acquired, by Don Bentley. This program was directed by Chris Kosheski, executive producer Dan Musselman, edited by JSR Post, LLC. Text copyright 2021 by the estate of Thomas L. Clancy, Jr., Rubicon Incorporated, Jack Ryan Enterprises Limited, and Jack Ryan Limited Partnership. Production copyright 2021, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this.